Hi, and welcome to the Hollywood Dreammaker podcast. I'm your host, Billy Gallo. I'm a 35-year veteran actor. I'm the kid who came out to Hollywood with 200 bucks in my pocket and a one-way ticket when I was 18. Didn't know a soul out here, and I've been living my dream ever since. I've had an amazing career. I've been an Academy Award-winning film, blockbuster film, hit TV series. You name it, I've done it, and I got the IMDb credits to prove it. 6 years ago, I opened up my own school, the Manhattan Actor Studio, where I found my true passion. That's teaching the craft of acting, but not only teaching the craft, but being the guy. Success leaves clues. I know how to make dreams a reality. I did it for myself, and I do it on a daily basis for my students. And I can help you achieve yours. Welcome to my podcast. Let's get started. I am super excited to introduce my guest. He's known as the Dr. Phil of script analysis by Creative Screenwriting Magazine. Blake Snyder bragged about him in his book, Save the Cat. I want to welcome Mike Chetta to the podcast. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hi, Billy.
It's nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
So we don't know each other. I was, you know, reading Save the Cat, and Blake was bragging about you. And I was like, who's this Mike Chetta guy? So I looked you up and I was like, I would love to have you on my podcast. And I called you up last minute and you jumped on. So I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
So, you know, I created this podcast to inspire other artists to follow their dreams. You know, if a kid like me can come out to Hollywood at 18 with 200 bucks in my pocket, a one-way ticket, not knowing a soul out here and making the dream a reality, then why can't the listener out there, right? You know, at some point you had a dream to be in this crazy business, this show business. So I'd like to go to the beginning. Like, when did you know you wanted to be in this business?
Actually, I was kind of, I stumbled into it. I was in college trying to find a major that I liked, and a friend, actually the night before registration, I was at a party because I went to the SF State in San Francisco, and they have a film school there, but I really wasn't aware of it at the time. And in San Francisco State at the time, it was to get a good class or get any kind of class, you basically had to stay up all night and line up outside the gym to register for the classes you wanted. Even if you don't know what classes they are, you want to be in that line. So we'd have a party. Traditionally, you have a big party on Sunday night. You know, everybody gets like shit faced. And can I, by the way,
yeah, you can.
Okay. So we'd all get loaded and then go stand in line. And, you know, the party would continue while we stumble. Then dawn breaks, the doors open, and we go in and register. And I didn't know what I was going to register. And the woman whose house we were in said, Mike, you should be in film. And I was, you know, I was like 19 years old. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. And I said, well, that sounds interesting. So I actually went in, registered for film classes, and I just loved it. And so I got a degree in film from SF State. And then I had to get like a job after graduation, and I ended up doing documentaries for a while. I worked in Canada for a while, in Toronto, for a TV network there. And then I did some writing, wrote sitcoms and all kinds of stuff. And then you kind of run out of stuff to do in Canada. Since I was an American, I could, you know, go home. So I came to LA, which is close to home, and through an acquaintance of somebody I knew in Toronto, got a job reading scripts at HBO. And I was older than most of the people that read scripts when they start reading scripts for professionally, and was kind of smart about comments I'd make, and I got noticed because I spoke up, and I got a job at HBO as an executive, and then I went from there to work at Disney, and then work at some back in the days when Eisner and Cassaberry had taken over Disney from Paramount, and that was my real education in the business, working for those two guys. They were so damn smart, and every meeting you had with them was a postgraduate course in filmmaking. They were just brilliant. They're brilliant guys. And so I was there for a while, and then I went to work as a is various small production companies. And then after working, you know, as an executive, a creative executive for a long time, I realized that there was a lot of really crappy writers making a lot of money. And actually, I was probably more talented than they were. So I started, you know, I decided I was just going to be a writer and did that and then worked at it. I met Blake while I was an executive, and we kind of were friends because we both loved analyzing movies and thinking about movies and thinking about theory about movies, and talked a lot of the stuff that's in Save the Cat came out of discussions that he and I had, as he says in the book. And so afterwards we teamed up and wrote some scripts together and sold some pitches, and we never actually got a movie made. He got a couple made, and I got one made. And then after I sort of aged out, as you'll see from the gray hair, I aged out of being a working screenwriter. And Blake published his book, and suddenly he called me up one day after he wrote it, not before it was published. He called me up one day and said, I hadn't talked to him for a long time, for, you know, maybe a year. And he said, well, I wrote this book, and actually you're in it. And do you have your domain name for yourself? And this is like in the 90s. He was talking gibberish to me. I have no idea what he's talking about. And I said, well, I put you down as, and it's in the, it's like, it's in the address is still exit. Cause he called me up and said, register this name, MikeTita.com. Call GoDaddy. He even told me how to do it. Call GoDaddy, register your own name. And sign up, because I'm going to publish this book and people might be calling you. And I swear I must get a contact still. 15 years after Blake's death, I still get at least one email or phone call a week from his book.
Wow, that's amazing. How did he pass?
Technically it was a pulmonary embolism. I think because he was doing a lot of traveling, because he got real popular. He went to China, he'd go to Europe, and he spent a lot of time on planes, and he was feeling lousy. Went to the doctor and went to the hospital feeling lousy one night, and we were like waiting on a deal. I was waiting for the phone to ring, because we had gone out with a pitch, and I was expecting our manager to call me, you know, with the results of the pitch, and he. Blake went to the doctor. Doctor said, you'll feel better tomorrow. And he died. It was a pulmonary embolism. Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. You know, when I was looking, you know, for Blake and I read that he passed, and I was like, well, it was very sad to hear that. You know, but he left, you know, left his legacy behind. I mean, Save the Cat is, you know, there for all writers.
And he was so proud of that, because he wanted to be remembered as the guy who wrote the book. It was meant a lot to him. So it's really nice when people talk about it, and you go online and people are arguing about what he means by this and what he means by that. And it's hilarious to me. He would love it.
So, you know, you guys collaborated and talked about it. I mean, is this your process, you know, the Save the Cat process? I mean, you know, it's got a very strict structure.
It's not our process. It's the process.
It's the process.
A book you should read, I mean, if you read Save the Cat, it would be redundant, but you might want to see Sid Field, S-Y-D Field, wrote a book called, I think it was called Writing the Screenplay.
Yeah.
It's what he did was he just figured out the formula. It's the formula that's always been used. The three-act structure has been the structure of movies and novels and plays forever. I think since Plato. And all Sid Field did was describe it. He called it the paradigm of movies. When I first read Sid Field's book, this is long before Save the Cat, I read Sid Field's book and I said, oh, come on, it can't be that simple. This has to be horseshit. So I actually sat down with some of my favorite movies. And back then it was VHS. And I played my favorite movies on a VHS player and timed when all the act breaks were. And God damn it, Sid Field was right. It was that three-act structure. It was like he nailed it. And so I was, and then, when, you know, I would, Blake and I would talk about it all the time. And he started doing his own thinking about how movies worked. And he's like way more entertaining to read than Sid Field. That's the joy of Save the Cat. He makes it all sound so, in fact, he makes it sound so flip and simple that you think this can't be real. You know, yeah. But it's the basic structure of, it's how people in Hollywood have always made movies. They've always had cork boards with plotting out stories. They've always had, you know, he was just exposing how the bones of how it was always done.
So for somebody who hasn't read Save the Cat, you know, what is that? I mean, I know it's got like, he says an opening image and a closing image and certain thing happens on page 10, you know, what is that structure?
I would call it the three act structure. It's like, it's just, most of it's just common sense that you want to, you're looking at a movie, and I'm the same way now. When I watch a movie, if they haven't engaged, especially now with streaming, where you're not trapped in a theater, where you're not going to paid your money, you're not going to get up if you don't know where you're going by page 10 or 10 minutes in. It's like the twitchy butt. It's a twitchy butt phenomena. That if you don't know what's going on, you're kind of like, oh, what, you know, what am I doing here? You know, because you need to let the audience know what to expect. So by page 10, you should know who the characters are. You should know kind of the direct, even though if you can change direction, certainly, you got to let the audience know they're going somewhere interesting and what the people are on about and what their issue is, kind of what the concept is. You got to get that across. And then then at the end of the first act, which is like a quarter of the way through the movie, you got to do a change of direction. There's usually, you know, if it's a quest, you want to, you know, that's in one of my favorite movies to use as an example of how to structure movies is Liam Neeson's Taken, mm-hmm. where that's when his daughter gets kidnapped. He spent the whole first act establishing their relationship, and then she gets kidnapped. Okay, and then that propels the rest of the movie. It's like that. So that's what happens at the end of the first act. Then the second act is usually is twice as long as the first act, and with kind of a shift in the middle. But that's muddy. That's an overemphasize. They call it the midpoint. People overemphasize the importance of that. It's not really. You just need like an hour of cool shit, and then building to the end of the second act. Where usually, especially in adventure movies, which I like and have made, it's like when you're fucked. Your protagonist is fucked. Whatever mm-hmm. he was going to plan isn't going to happen. Whoever the bad guy is, he's reversed. You know, it turns out that he's inside the whatever. He's got the drop on the good guy. In James Bond movies, that's when you know the James Bond is tied to the shark or to the buzzsaw or to the atomic reactor or whatever the all is lost moment is, that's that moment. And that's the end of the second act. And the third act is all about resolving the story. That's the three act structure as brief as I can make it.
Right. So if I'm a young aspiring writer or an actor that has an idea, you know, I tell my actors all the time, you know, don't wait, create your own projects. You know, you have this cool little device in your phone, you know, this phone in your back pocket. I mean, you can write, shoot, you can edit, you can do everything in it. Now, I mean, back in the day when I came into town, you know, in 1984, there were no cell phones. There was no GPS. I mean, it was like a paper map and, you know, the bus and, you know, you didn't have those tools, but now they have this cool tool. I mean, they can literally dictate a script if they don't know how to type. I mean, there's apps that you can, you know, just speaking into it.
I mean, you know, are you familiar with the film Tangerine?
Yes. Yeah.
Which was all shot on an iPhone.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Years ago. And now technology is even better. I mean, that's all you need. All you need is a good idea, some compelling characters, you know, some idea of what you want to do. I mean, look at Curb Your Enthusiasm. There's an entire series without a script. There's no script. There are very detailed outlines, but Larry David just gets people who are good at improvising, gives them a really fun story, and lets them go.
Yeah. So I'm looking at your library behind you, and you got a lot of books over there. So, you know, if I'm a young aspiring writer, you know, you mentioned Sid Field's book. What are some of the other books that I should read?
None of them.
None of them.
Go read screenplays. go watch the movies that they're based on, and classic ones. I mean, I can't tell you how many times this has happened. I've said, go watch a Preston Sturges movie to somebody who's contacted me through the book. And they said, yeah, but he's like, oh, that's so long ago. Watch the movies. You're still laughing at the line. They're still funny. You watch good silent movies. You're still laughing. It's still, I was watching, what was I watching the other day? One of the Marx Brothers movies, like from the 30s. And it's still funny. It's basic stuff. But read, the first thing I tell people to do, get the names of all the Academy Award winning screenplays, read them all, watch the movies, and just keep doing that. See what works. Because all the books are like, if you read Sidfield, you read Blake's book, that's the basics. More books isn't going to help. What's going to help is watching the movies. Take notes, read the scripts, see what it looks like on the page. See what changes a director made. Frequently, movies are worse than the scripts.
Yeah.
And sometimes movies are better than the books they're based on. Mostly not. Famously, James M. Cain thought Double Indemnity's script is way better than his book, which it is. If you read both, you'll see it is. And Billy Wilder's a fucking genius.
So what exactly do you do? Your service that you provide?
Oh, people, if you go to our website, it's like I read scripts and give people opinions about them. I try to figure out, if there's issues. Sometimes I read scripts and they're great, very rarely, but I try to give them pointers or hints or about what directions they can go or where they've gone off because you talk about people coming to Hollywood and getting into the business as an actor or a writer. Actors have a much tougher time than writers in terms of the path, because all you have to do as a writer is sit at your little computer in some coffee shop or wherever or on the back of a hay bale in Wisconsin and write a great script. And if you write a really great script, someone's going to buy it and make it. Because there's very few. I get tons of scripts all the time. Rarely do I get one that's really good. Sometimes I get scripts that are by talented people that are making mistakes, and that's really easy to fix. But a lot of it is just people that don't have enough experience writing or working in the business or haven't read as many scripts as they should have or watched as many movies as they should have. And that's more of an uphill battle. But if you have a great script that's like, you're in the business. You're all because people will want it. They'll fight over it. Whereas an actor, it's like you got to kick down doors. It's hard.
So let's say you've written that great script, right? And you're in on that hay bale writing it. You don't really know. I mean, how do you get it out there? I mean, if you don't have an agent?
You go to the WGA, which you don't have to belong to access. They have a list on their website of agents that take unsolicited manuscripts. And if you write a truly brilliant script, someone will read it and someone will want to represent it.
So you mentioned WGA. So, I've written this great script and what do I want to register with the Writers Guild? How do I protect my material? What's the best approach to that? Do you have to copy?
It's a non-issue.
It's a non-issue.
People that aren't in the business, in the writing business, are all obsessed about that. They get there are copyright lawyers who will take your money and copyright your screenplay. They will. This minute you finished writing it, it's automatically copyrighted. You don't need to do that. People will take your money to do it. Definitely. Lawyers will be happy to take your money to do all kinds of shit.
So it's not necessary to go to the Library of Congress and copyright your script and
all you have to do is have some way of identifying that you wrote it. Because even you can copyright it, you can trademark it, you can register it with the Writers Guild. And Blake actually when we worked on stuff, he'd always insist on doing all the Writers Guild does is take a copy of what you've done, put it in an envelope, and put it in a box. They have it, so it exists. So then, if you send it out and someone plagiarizes it and takes your written material, and uses it without paying you, you can say, yeah, but I wrote this and I can prove it because it's in the box at the Writers Guild, and they will ascertain that yes, indeed, this is what, you know, Michael Blick wrote, yada yada. You can do the same thing. You just send yourself a self-addressed envelope with the material in it. It creates the same thing, because you're still going to have to prove that the person stole it. You can have to prove, one, that they got hold of it somehow. There was a connection where someone sent it to them, because ideas are all over the place. I mean, you can't really copyright or protect an idea. What you can do is copyright or protect your written work. If you have a scene that has identifiable characters and dialogue and descriptions and unique action, and someone actually copies that and uses it, then that is actionable. Someone has the same idea. I mean, look at, you know, Sopranos was about the concept was a gangster goes to see a shrink, and it's like a big scandal in gangster world. That was the original concept of Sopranos. It clearly grew to be bigger than that. The same year was the movie Analyze This. Mm-hmm. with De Niro and Billy Crystal. It's the same idea, you know?
Yeah.
One didn't steal from the other. It was just an idea that someone thought, you know, is out there. And Sopranos ran for, 5 years? And Analyze This had a sequel. So.
Yeah, they were both great.
Same idea, same year. So actually, you hear this all the time. People say, well, someone just did my idea, so I should abandon it. No. First of all, if someone just did it, by the time you actually would get it out of the production tunnel, you know, at the end of the development process, it's going to be like 5 or 6 years from now, and no one will remember whatever it is just came out. So
don't worry about that. So you're saying this development tunnel is a 5-6 year process?
Or if you're lucky.
Okay.
It can be a 20-year process. I mean, ask your buddy George. Yeah. It's like, it can, yeah, stuff, it yeah. goes on forever.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I have scripts that I'm, you know, still working on that I wrote 20 years ago. So, you
and
know,
before, I mean, I'm talking about the development process after they buy it. You know, after they buy it, it still can go years. And they forget. They forget they own it.
Yeah. What about like I'm writing something right now and it's based on my life story, like life rights.
You own your life rights, so it's you, because it's you.
But if somebody wanted to buy the script, would they have to buy the life rights? Is that how it works?
Yeah, they would. I don't know how that agreement would work. But yes, you would agree to sell not only the written material for a certain price, but you may, and I don't know whether it would just be included as part of as a paragraph in that agreement, or if there'd be a separate agreement. You have to talk to an entertainment attorney about that. I don't know. But yeah, you would sell both. You have to sell all rights.
You know, in your experience in reading many scripts for HBO, and, you know, I mean, is there something that, you know, you feel like that's a sellable project to focus? You know, I know the horror genre, it probably sells a little easier than some of the others. You know, is there a genre that, you know, you want to kind of focus in on if you're just starting out?
Something you're comfortable with, stuff, something you like. You know, I mean, I for some reason fell into doing action movies, so that was kind of my genre. But you know, what are you good at? If you're funny, right? Comedies. Especially if you're an actor and you identify with you know, stage work and you're good with characters, you know, then you do, you know, character study, kind of, you know, character driven stories. It all depends what you're comfortable, which you have to determine that, what you're comfortable with.
How is it important for, you know, writers to understand the business side of Hollywood?
That's, you hire people to do that for you. I mean, I people keep saying, well, you want to write a certain budget, and you want to keep your costs low, keep it small. Well, that's fine if you're producing your own stuff. You want to do that. But in terms of getting attention, if you're on the hay bale in Wisconsin, let it rip. Just let there are people that worry about that shit. You don't let it strap you down. Don't let it impede your creativity.
So write it, you know, write it big, let it go, whatever. If I have a scene on a plane, it doesn't have to be on a bus.
Exactly. There's lots of shit that's going to happen to your work before it gets in front of a camera.
What advice do you have for writers that are struggling to get into the business?
You're not there yet. You need to do another draft, make it better. Because they'll get in the business if they're good. They'll break in. And you know this. Actors know this more than anybody. I mean, that's what they call it: breaking into show business. You have to basically kick the door down and break in. You know that.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I did.
Everybody does.
I literally, when I got to Hollywood, you know, at 18 years old, I went over to Warner Brothers and I got to the guard gate, and the guard at the gate said, "Sorry, kid, you can't come in." And I was like, oh, okay. I'm from Brooklyn. I walked around the building. I climbed the wall. I climbed over the chain link fence and I jumped onto the lot, and I spent the whole day on the lot. I met Kevin Bacon. He was filming a movie. I hung out. Nobody knew I just jumped a lot. I'm not advising anybody to do that now, but back in 1984, you know, I was, don't tell me I can't come in. I'm coming in. You know, I'm breaking.
And that's why you've been able to make a living in Hollywood.
Yeah, you got to be relentless in the pursuit of it. And you got to, know that you're going to get no's, and no's are okay. You know, never
until you
know.
Get a yes. Eventually, yeah. It become a yes. Eventually, somehow, if you keep at it, if you quit, stop doing that, you'll never get the yes. You're never going to get there. Yeah.
You know, feedback, you know, in the evolution of a screenplay. I mean, how important is that to get feedback?
It's essential, but you have to find some way to edit out the noise, because everybody has an opinion, you know. Everybody goes to movies. Everybody's an expert, and there's, you know, you get people that are especially doing the kind of thing I do, which now is just, you know, be a consultant, as it were. You see people doing the same thing online. And I would say people say, well, so-and-so said this about my script. And I said, go to IMDb, check their credits. If someone doesn't have a credit, if someone doesn't have the experience of getting something made and seeing what goes into it.
Yeah. Don't listen
to
them.
Well,
I see it all the time. You know, I mean, I have an acting school here, you know, for 10 years. You know, this is a real theater. It's not a green screen, you know, and there are people out there, and I get it because I typed in actor in a search box before. And now I get all these sponsored ads for acting classes. And then I look them up just out of curiosity on IMDb, and they got zero credits. They did a short film, and it's like, now they're the authority. They're telling you how to make it as an actor in the business. And I laugh because it's like, please don't listen to those. Vet whoever who's giving you that, you know, that advice on how to become a working writer or a working actor, you know, make sure they've made some money doing it. They've actually had a career.
Well, it's not so much, the making money is important. That's how you know you're a professional, is someone sent you money. You worked for it. They paid you to do that function, whatever that function is. But it's also the experience of seeing how it works. I worked, you know, for years in Toronto in the business. I worked for a TV network there. I had a lot of experience. I had 150 hours of screen credits on various, live TV and documentaries. And so I was hot shit there. I came here and got exposed to how it's done here. I didn't know anything. I got in a room with, you know, Eisner and Katzenberg at Disney, you know, when they first took over. Oh, God, I was a complete moron. I didn't know anything.
What is the biggest lesson you learned from them?
It's not a lesson, it's a list.
Anything stands out on that list?
Once a week, I was in the TV movie department and doing development. And every week we had to come up with five new ideas, most of which we got from taking pitch meetings, which we did endlessly. And we had to pitch them. And they had, this is just to buy a pitch. They had in the room, they had the finance department, they had the props department, there was like 30 people in the room to listen to your pitch. and they wanted to make, if anybody had a problem with it, they wanted to know then. Not when it was a script, after they spent, you know, $20,000 or $40,000, whatever it was then, on getting a script written. They wanted to know before they spent a penny why they wouldn't go ahead or why they would go ahead with the project. It was a lesson in control. And they would usually reject everything in the room and have fabulous reason. I mean, they were really good. Actually, the best, I remember Eisner's, well, I remember one thing he said that was so cool was, he said, if it's a great concept, the execution doesn't have to be as good, and vice versa. Hmm. There was a thought concept, and Blake in his book talks about, you know, high concept and not high concept. If it's not a high concept, then the execution has to be superb.
Let's talk about the pitch, right? You know, if you do get an opportunity to pitch your story, right? You know, if you're lucky enough to get into the door, or maybe it's that elevator pitch, you know, where you got to kind of pitch them and, you know, you got to have a strong log line, right? I mean, what's your thoughts about log lines?
Well, the log line is just a reflection of the concept. So if your log line is mushy, it means your idea is mushy. You got, you know, it's just not, you don't have it. The idea should be simple enough. And Blake goes through this, and we literally used to do this. The mall is gone now. It's a Google office building. But we go to the mall at, what was it called? At the corner of Pico and Overland. We saw it because I lived down here by the marina, and he lived in Beverly Hills. So we'd meet there to work at the food court. And what we do, we come up with ideas. And then he would take a clipboard. He would really do this. And he says that he talks about it in the book. And we do a market research. We actually stop people at the top of the escalator and say, so would you what do you think about this idea? And we pitch them the idea right there, just off the street. Huh. If you have a clipboard, they think you're, you know, it's official of some sort.
That's funny.
Yeah. And when you pitch an idea to someone, and the same thing at parties, when you go to, you pitch an idea, you can look in the, they'll all say, oh, that sounds great. But you look at their eyes and you can see that moment of getting it, you know, where you look in their eyes and they're like, you can see them go, oh yeah. Or they are just dead eyes. Dead eyes, bad idea. The twinkle in the eye, good idea. Because everyone will say, if they're, especially at a party, oh, that's great.
I'm going to read you my log line.
Okay.
A little boy must survive his home life in the mean streets of Brooklyn in the 70s. The only thing keeping him alive are his dreams.
What's that? What is that?
So it's a story about a little boy from a...
I can get it. It sounds like...
Yeah, because...
There has to be something else that... Because I think, you know, I've sort of heard that story. You know, cool. It's got to be something about it that grabs me. You know,
yeah. So that's my whole. I you know, log lines are hard to do. It's like trying to figure out how to.
Well, you're missing something in your concept. You're missing something.
Okay.
I think about, you know, I mean, Woody Allen came from, I guess, a similar background. I would assume, you know, many years before you, but he would ride the subway to his job, and he would make himself write 100 jokes on a subway ride every day.
Wow.
Yeah. Now that sounds interesting. See, I got you, you know, that character I'm interested in.
Yeah, I mean, that's a discipline to write 100 jokes every day.
And he could do it, and they're probably all funny.
Yeah.
Which is terrifying. You know. But that's just an example of something that's unusual, that is not just a kid. You know, you have to, you know, Henry Hill in Goodfellas had a similar background. He was working class family. He was kind of, you know, wanted to get out of there. He became a gangster. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's another interesting twist on the same environment that you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, there's elements of that in my story. I mean, that's when I kind of got lost into that world.
But find an element, a particular element that you can focus on and then develop that and pitch that. And then once you get the really good concept that sounds exciting in just the log line, it sounds more exciting than what you already have, then write the script based on that. Because you need a hook of some sort. There's not just another, you know, slice of life coming of age story.
Got it.
What was the film that what was it called? Clive Owen plays this guy who's like a plumber or something. And I wish I could remember the name of the film. Who lost his tools, and the whole movie is him and his kid going around trying to get his tools back. But he has a quest. It's a coming of age in Massachusetts, but it becomes a quest. You know, so now even though it's all about growing up and the people in his life and all the things you probably have in your story, but the hook is just a simple quest to get, because the guy has a job, a promise of a job. He's been out of work, and he has no tools. He can't take the job unless he has his tools. And it's a simple, kind of a dumb quest, but it carries the movie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for me, it was, you know, I was 11 years old and Universal Pictures came to my block in Brooklyn and they parked all their trucks on my block. And they were filming a movie called Nunzio. And Morgana King, who played Marlon Brando's wife in The Godfather, she was one of the leads in the film. And I was an 11-year-old boy coming home from the park, and I saw all the cameras in the trucks, and I ran down the street, and I said, "What's going on here?" And she said, "We're making a movie." I go, "How do you get in a movie? I want to be in a movie." So she showed me a picture and a resume. I ran home, took a Polaroid picture of me, wrote some stuff down on a loose leaf paper and ran down the street and gave her my picture and resume. And she laughed. She got, you know, told the director said, "Go home, kid, you know, get your parents. We're going to stick you in a movie." And I ran home and, Mom, they're going to stick me in a movie." And my mother said, "You stay in the house. You don't know what kind of movie they're making down there." And I ran down the street. I grabbed the director by the arm. I said, "My mother doesn't believe you. You got to tell her you're going to put me in the movie." And he said, "We're Universal Pictures. We're going to pay your son." My mother said, "You're going to pay him? Got to take him." So I showed up and I got to the set and there was a little actor who had a speaking role in it. And I looked identical to him. Everybody thought I was him, but he wasn't working that day. So they gave me the star treatment. I got into makeup. I got a little powder on my nose, a little craft service. I told me I can eat anything I want. And that's when I got, you know, and I walked onto that, you know, magical world, the set. They build all the interior sets on my block in a bungalow. And it was like Hollywood was on my block, a soundstage. And that's when I got bit by the bug and I knew I wanted to be an actor, you know, and it was truly.
So let me give you a log line.
Okay.
So an 11-year-old kid, where are you growing up?
Brooklyn, New York.
Of course. Well, how could it be anywhere else? So, an 11-year-old kid growing up in Brooklyn in what year?
1976.
Okay, in the 70s, a movie comes to shoot in his neighborhood, and he drives the entire crew crazy until he actually gets himself a part in the movie. There's your log line.
Cool.
I'm interested in that.
Awesome.
I may be more interested because I threw it back at you, but nevertheless, it sounds like I can see something.
Got it.
The way you pitched, I couldn't see anything. I just saw it's another coming of age story.
Got it. So what are the elements?
Terrific. I like that.
Huh?
What you pitched me, the longer version, the elevator version. I mean, I pitched back a log line, but you pitched the elevator version.
Well, you know, yeah, I did that, right? And some casting director gave my mother his business card and said, "You know, I can help your son. Give me a call."
But I think the whole movie should be what you pitched. That should be the whole movie. But I don't care about the rest.
So the rest gets better though. So my mother ripped up that card. and I was like, "My mother doesn't believe in me." So a year later, Saturday Night Fever came to town, and John Travolta was filming in my neighborhood down the street from me. And I ran down the street, and there was hundreds of screaming girls, and I worked my way to John Travolta, and I knocked on his door, and he gave me his autograph, and I told him I wanted to be an actor. And he told me, you should do it. Go after it, kid. And he it was like, what? You're like, I can do this? Like, I mean, there was Vinnie Barbarino telling me I could do it. So, you know, that event was really powerful, like watching him film that, you know, Saturday Night Fever in my neighborhood. And that, you know, started me on a journey to become an actor. It was those two films in my neighborhood that made me who I am today.
Now, you're not going to do better than the first story. I'm sorry. You got me. That could be a whole, I'm telling you, it can be a whole movie. Just an 11-year-old kid being a pain in the ass.
Yeah, I once again, it was like when I got to the gate, you know, the guy, they said, sorry, kid, you can't come in. Well, I climbed the roof and jumped from roof to roof to roof and got in, and I shimmied down and I went down the fire escape and I got into the place. And he was like, how'd you get in here? And I was like, he let me in.
Yeah. But you see what I mean in terms of log lines? It's making, and by the way, in terms of pitches, you as an actor have a huge advantage over tongue-tied writers, because you're used to performing stuff. This is just your stuff.
Yeah.
Instead of somebody else's, but you have a huge advantage.
So other than going to the Writers Guild and looking, you know, how else can somebody who's just starting out get their script seen? Like, you know, like there's the blacklist or whatever. I mean, what do you believe? What are your thoughts on that?
It's all, you know, I mean, people on Reddit like swear by it. They're all very excited. I don't know. I haven't tried to sell something, you know, in a long time. So I don't know how it works now. I mean, I understand from people who are working writers that like writing a pilot is now a good idea, apparently, whereas I would have thought back in the day it was not a good idea. But you need to find some way to put on paper that you have skill and that you're able to realize characters, you can tell a story, it all kind of looks like a professional script. You know, the final draft kind of does that for you. You know, you just has just quality. People will pay for quality. That's why, you know, that's why they pay you.
Yeah. How has the industry changed, you know, since, you know, when you were starting out?
Well, I movies used to be good, and now they're kind of shitty. I'm so disappointed in my art, as it were, because it's like half the time I didn't even bother seeing half the nominated movies this year because they didn't look interesting, and the ones I did see I didn't like. I'm so disappointed. Whereas on TV, on streaming, there's some really good stuff. I mean, there's some excellent material. I mean, Shogun is fabulous, except for, you know, for who's that that weird actor the round eye actor they have? He's not good, I don't think. But
did you say Shogun?
Yeah, it's on Hulu.
Okay, I haven't seen it.
It's a remake. Did you ever see the original with Richard Chamberlain?
I have not, no.
Well, by the way, they're based on and that's an example of how nobody ever usually gets worse from the book. The original book by James Clavell, Shogun, which is big, thick, it's in here somewhere, is a great read. If you want to read a really great novel. I mean, it's not literature, but it's a great adventure, and it's you will not put it down. It's like you'll be up nights reading it. It's really good. And so that was done, I think, around 1980 as a miniseries with Richard Chamberlain, who was back then the king of the miniseries. He was in every miniseries, and so he was in Shogun, and I mean, it's a story about an Englishman who shipwrecks in Japan, which just doesn't have any foreigners, and you know, it kind of becomes a samurai. It's just a great portrait of Japan.
I do remember that. It was like something in the 70s, 80s, right? They did
this by 1980, I think. I'm guessing.
Yeah, I do remember that. Now.
Yeah, it's pretty good. And so it's been remade as a miniseries, and it's airing now. They have two more episodes on Hulu.
Cool. I got to check it out.
Yeah.
So can you share some examples of successful films that have effectively utilized the principles outlined in Save the Cat?
All of them.
All of them.
Yes, that's the whole point of Save the Cat. And people don't get it. Except for, I mean, bad movies sometimes don't follow it. And people try to, you know, you've seen the Zone of Interest movie?
Zone of Interest?
Yeah, got an Academy Award for foreign language screen or whatever. I don't know what.
I did not see it. No.
Avoid it. It's got an Academy Award. I watched Lenny, which was, I'm watching it. Maestro. And I'm watching it. And I actually watched it with a friend of mine who's a Emmy Award winning costume designer. And we're both watching it with, you know, centuries of experience. And we're watching this here. And halfway through it, I turned to her and said, what is this about? You know, because because you think it's good when you're watching it, because it's so well done.
Yeah.
I mean, the craft is just, how Bradley Cooper didn't get the Academy Award, I have no idea, because it was so much better performance than Oppenheimer. Well, Oppenheimer is a better movie.
His performance was amazing.
It was amazing. Yeah. I'm watching going, that's Bradley Cooper?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's the best performance since Oldham as Churchill. I mean, it was like amazing. But the movie was just, let's show Bradley Cooper being in makeup and in good costumes and good everything. I mean, it was the craft on it was just astonishing. Yeah. But it was basically about his wife putting up with his shenanigans. I mean, the title should have been Lenny's Beard, you know, that's what it was about.
Yeah. I mean, I thought, you know, his performance was amazing. I mean, the dramatic structure of the story, like you said, what is it? Well, you know, that's what I'm struggling right now with my screenplay is like, you know, I want to make sure that by page 10, you know exactly what you're looking at. You know, I had some scenes in it early on that were, you know, kind of pushing in a different direction. And it's like, what are we watching here? I mean, that was
exactly. Essential. Back in the day, the joke used to be that when you're an executive, you take like 10 screenplays home with you every weekend, you know, and you get through it, but you're reading them. And if by page 10, you don't know what's going on, you just pitch it. You're done. You know, because you don't have time to waste on people that don't know what they're doing.
So if somebody wanted to, you know, have you read their script, what's the best way for them to reach you?
They go to my website, mikejeter.com, and there's instructions.
Right. So if you could go back and give some advice to the younger Mike, life advice, career advice, what would that advice be?
Well, job's not taken. I had opportunities to go one direction, and I went another direction, and I probably fucked up, you know, to take some jobs that I shouldn't have taken and pass on some jobs that I did take, you know, so those kinds of things.
Got it. And, you know, for that, once again, for that kid that's got a dream about, you know, breaking into the business as a screenwriter, what's the best advice you can give them?
Write a good script. It's really simple. That's all you have to do. Seriously, just write a good script, but it has to be good. Don't try to shop it before you're really convinced that you can't do a single thing with it, that you use one of the rating services that's online or someone like me or whatever, everybody's looked at it and they say, oh, this is great.
Yeah.
Because no one argues about a great script. There's so few of them.
Yeah. And writing is rewriting and polishing and rewriting.
Yeah. And it's really hard, and nobody does it. Everyone thinks that I have a great idea, and I wrote it. And my brother says, oh my God, you finished that script. That's great. So you're ready to send it to an agent. No, don't do that, because you're going to burn a bridge.
Yeah, you get one opportunity.
Once they see your script with your name on it, with your story, and they read it and it's not there yet, they're like, they don't want to read it again. Unless it's a very particular circumstance where someone loves the idea, they're totally wedded to it. And they say, well, I got to see the draft. Where is the draft? I'm very excited about it. That's rare. That happens. If you write something really good, you will either you'll sell it or you'll get yourself a job. I mean, that's just, I can pretty much guarantee it, but it's predicated on writing the great script, which is really, really hard.
Yeah. I mean, it's an art form. You know, people think it's easy. It's really, it's a dedication to the craft.
It's more of a craft than an art. I mean, a lot of art is involved for sure, but it's learning the craft. Cause I've written terrible scripts that looked really, cause someone wanted me to do certain things. I'm not going to bring any names about it, but it looked like it was a good script. I can make a script look exciting. You know, cause there's tricks.
I got a question. I was looking at my scene count, right? Is there a certain amount of scenes that go into a screenplay, or, you know, because I have a lot of scenes. I have like 140 something scenes.
Back to what I said, bro, don't worry about shit like that.
Okay.
You know, just make it exciting.
Got it.
And make it easy to read. I mean, I'm a big believer in what's called vertical writing, you know, which has a lot of white space. I mean, Blake and I, when we write a script together, we thought we were finished, we'd go back and just look for white space. If you had pages that didn't have a lot of white space, we'd break shit up, break speeches up, break action up, just to make it, because the more white space you have, the faster, it's one of the tricks you can use, is the faster you're turning the page, and you think it's more exciting than it is, because you're flipping through the page. Whoa, look at that. You know.
It's a page turner.
yeah, and you can trick people into turning the page. It's by white space, using white space.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to, once I get my polish done, I'm going to send you my script. I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, but get... And start with the concept. I mean, you have a physical advantage over anybody because you're an actor, so it's natural for you to pitch. The rest of us have, you know, but get your concept down so where it comes, like the little pitch I threw back at you about the kid trying to get in the movie. That to me sounded more interesting than what you pitched. Find a version of your story that pitches that simply. And then get people to validate it by pitching it to them. Then write that down, stick it on like a board, and then blot that out. Blot that out. Don't write what you're already writing. Write the pitch, the concept, and don't vary from it. And stuff that isn't that you like. You know, you've heard the term "killing your darlings."
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure you have lots of, especially since it's based on your life, lots of really cool shit that you want to include. If it doesn't fit into that concept, nope. Save it for another day. But just write that concept and keep it exciting. And that's, you know, but stick to the concept.
Got it. Awesome. Mike, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And this is so much more fun than actually doing work.
Well, I'm going to be in touch, Mike.
Okay, Billy. Good talking to you.
It was a pleasure meeting you.
Say hello to everybody behind you in the seats.
Will do. All right, take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show. Please rate, review, share this with your friends. Subscribe if you haven't. Please take whatever you get from here, the golden nuggets, and apply them to your career. Go after your dreams with passion. Don't let anybody tell you it can't be done. I believe in you. Follow your dreams. I'll see you in Hollywood.